You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
Very excited about today's episode. You know, as we're putting together shows that we want to do over the coming years, at this point, it's really not haphazard. We're trying to create a show that serves you, our community, our audience, where you are, realizing that we're all following different paths. We're doing it from different income levels, different walks of life, different obstacles that we're pursuing. And one thing that I feel like I've seen is that this would be great if I earned more, if I had a higher income. But because of the profession I chose, because of the industry that I'm in, I'm stuck. And I think the reason I'm so excited about this episode today, we're going to be speaking with Stephen and Lauren, who write over at tripofalifestyle.com. And what's fascinating about their story is these two individuals graduated from college with minimal debt, but graduated to, I would say, low to the upper end of low income salaries together. They were making, I would say, probably a entry-level teacher salary out the gate. But somehow, while many people would say, all right, that's my course, you know, I can save only this amount, and the next 10, 15 years, I'll be able to have this at the end. And, you know, maybe they're satisfied with the number, but maybe they're not. These two individuals didn't limit themselves to that idea, that framework. Instead, throughout today's episode, we'll actually discuss how over a two-year period of time, they're actually able to save over $100,000, again, on teachers' salaries, how they were able to take a six-month trip to Hawaii for $0 for their honeymoon, and how they were able to visit every single national park in the United States in their 20s. Does that sound like something you'd be interested in finding out more about? Brad.
Yes, you bet. Yeah, absolutely. Lauren actually reached out to me because we were talking on the podcast about a trip my family was planning to take to visit a few of the national parks. And when I really dove into their content, I said, these are people we have to have on the podcast. Just because by the age of 29, they've lived these incredible lives. And like you said, there are limiting beliefs. So many people have limiting beliefs of, I don't make enough to save. Oh, I could never take that trip of a lifetime, right? Not less two of them in my 20s. But yet, this couple did it and they're thriving. And that's a story I want to learn more about. So with that, Stephen and Lauren, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, how's
Thanks
it going?
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, glad you're here. And I want to say, when I did the setup for this, you know, I was talking about teacher salaries. I believe only one of you was a teacher, but let me just see if I was at least close to accurate with the salary range. My wife, when she started working, I believe when she started, she was making about $35,000 that first year as a teacher. Is that close or accurate, or what were y'all making when you graduated from college?
So my starting pay as a teacher was just over $38,000, and I got a master's degree after my first year and got a huge raise to $42,000. So,
and throughout that time period, I was making a little bit less working in marketing.
Okay. All right. So together combined, you had a salary that approached $70,000. Is that fair?
A little over 70 combined, yeah.
Okay. So now I'd like to actually talk about, I mean, because what we're going to actually discuss is incredible. This ability to save $100,000 in around 2 years on that salary, like that doesn't even add up. Like it just doesn't even make any sense. So we're going to get to that. But what I want to actually talk about is behind the scenes here. It's one thing to graduate and have entry-level salaries. It's another thing to do it without significant student loan debt. And from that perspective, what did you come into your first job with? Did you have significant student loan debt? Were you able to achieve scholarships individually or together? What did that look like?
Yeah, so in undergrad, I had what Florida State offers is the Bright Futures program. It's a scholarship that covers most of your tuition, but like nothing else. So while Bright Futures covered my tuition, I still had to work to cover my expenses. And I did that by taking the highest paying job I could qualify for, which was working at a restaurant. And I know a lot of people kind of have the stigma about the minimum wage of a restaurant worker, but with tips included, I was generally making like $20+ an hour. So it really helped cover expenses while putting myself through college.
Lauren, what did those expenses look like in a calendar year, roughly? So just kind of give us a sense, like room and board, were you living in an apartment? Were you sharing a place with five roommates? Like, what does this look like? What did you have to cover?
Yeah, so thankfully, the University of Florida is in Gainesville, Florida, which is a pretty low cost of living area. My first 2 years, I was living with roommates. I think at one point there were six of us in the three-bedroom townhouse, Stephen included. And then Stephen and I moved into our own one-bedroom apartment about halfway through college. And I think that my half of rent for all of that time frame was like $250 to like $300 a month. And then there's, you know, internet, which we split. I didn't have a car payment because I bought my car outright, but I had to pay for insurance and gas and obviously food. I think that I just had health insurance through the university, or I was on my parents, so I wasn't paying for insurance at the time. And then my cell phone bill. I think that's most of it. Do you remember anything else that we had? I feel like that.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. I don't really remember what it was annually, but I know that I got my expenses down to where if I was making $300 a month, I could pay all my bills. And about partway through college, I realized like, oh, I'm serving at this restaurant. I'm making decent money, saving some, but I need to like have something on my resume that's not just being a waitress. And so I sought out an internship at the local paper. And then I was offered a position at the paper after my internship. And I was kind of nervous because I didn't know how much it would pay. You know, I was making $20 an hour at the restaurant, but then I had to kind of wait for news to happen for me to be able to write about it and get paid for it. And so it really kind of, I had to do these different calculations, and I came up with, if I just made $300 a month in news, then I could pay all my bills. And my future boss and I sat down, we talked about it, and I said, you know, how many hours could I work if I was doing, you know, X, Y, or Z type of jobs, if I took on photography as well, you know, if I cobbled these different freelancing gigs through the paper together, could I make that? And is that somewhat kind of guaranteed? Is there a way that you can tell me like, yeah, I'll make that happen for you? And that's kind of how I took that leap into my first kind of career steps. And I think that really helped set me off in a way that I could kind of advance after college, that I had this work history on my resume graduating that I could ask for a better job or better pay going into my like first full-time adult job.
Yeah, there's a couple of things there that are interesting to me. One is, you know, recognizing what that core expenses look like, keeping those expenses so lean that you could afford to take, you know, a risky, lower paying job, recognizing that the path that you wanted to go that would give you more freedom and a salary that's more in your own creative space. It's not always straight up, right? Sometimes it's a jungle gym. And, you know, as you guys graduate college and you're taking on these roles, and Stephen, I don't want to bypass your student loan story. Do you have an amazing student loan story that you want to share with us right now?
I don't have that amazing of a story. I graduated debt-free, but I had scholarships and I did have some help from my parents through college.
All right. It's boring. No. You guys have done plenty of interesting stuff.
Congrats, but it's boring.
Moving on.
That's fair.
All right. No, but I really want to go to these first jobs. I mean, we're talking, like, we're going to go through how we accomplished these really incredible things, but I want to start with, you have entry-level salaries, yet you two individuals find a way to save $100,000 in 2 years. Mathematically, that doesn't even make sense. Like, that's impossible based on the numbers you just gave me.
Are you going to use the word literally?
If I haven't said it yet, that shows restraint. But it would be the correct, can I just clarify, it would be the correct usage of the word literally in this case. Mad Feinstein sometimes says
it's
metaphor.
It's not literally impossible.
It is not, because 150. Because we
did. Well, based on the, all right, so let's talk about how is it possible, right? They say that if you believe something is possible or impossible, you're right. And clearly you didn't, you know, stop at that limiting belief, but you solved the problem. How does one save $100,000 in 2 years on entry-level salaries?
Yeah, so I'll preface this by saying if I mess up any of the numbers, there is a complete write-up on that first 100K on our blog, but I think I'll get them all right. So we were making, you know, to start out, something like $75,000 to $80,000 in salary combined. And then on top of that, we've run a photography business for actually since like late in college together. And so that, along with some other side hustles like buying and selling stuff on eBay and some other just random little gigs that we've found, probably added another 10K or so to our combined income. And then during this 2-year period following college, we were living in near Orlando, Florida, in a relatively low cost of living, like suburb area. So our total expenses combined for the two of us there were around like $20,000 to $22,000 a year. And during this time, of course, we were investing as well. So all that money we were saving along the way during those 2 years did come during a bull market. We didn't have very much of a portfolio. We're starting pretty much from zero at this point, but we did see some gains over that time period. And I think we made probably like $10,000 in like capital gains and dividends over the 2 years as well. So when you add all that stuff up, comes out to over $100,000 saved, if I got all those numbers right.
Okay, so just to summarize this, so you're making about $75,000 in salary, you're making about $10,000 per year in these additional incomes, photography, et cetera. So you're at $85,000 a year, roughly. So $170,000 total income, less taxes, less the $22,000 per year in expenses, yep, gets you to that $100,000. So yes, it is literally possible.
Plus about $10,000 in investment gains.
Right, but right, yes, right. Yep. That's still incredible, though. Wow.
Yeah, so, but you guys did this together, and you did it really early on, and so many people aren't able to get on the same page with their partner, or they aren't able to maybe make what may have felt like a hard sacrifice. In order to save that amount, you have to not spend that amount. And both of you made that choice together and were able to pull it off for 2 years, and the subsequent years after, I guess we can talk about that in a little bit. What got you there to be able to be on the same page and see the long-term vision with kind of this, hey, we graduated from college, we can finally afford furniture, you know, like how did you get on the same page?
Well, we didn't buy new furniture. We actually had a lot of the same college stuff that we kept from college into our like new adult lives. But
in general, like, I think our outlook on it was, we saw pretty early on that saving money and investing money can buy you freedom. So having that kind of mindset shift, I guess, really put us on the same page, because we were like, yeah, it doesn't really make sense to spend more. We enjoyed our college lifestyle. We had a lot of fun. So why does that really need to change? We can keep just like living in a one bedroom apartment. And at this point, we were sharing one car and I was riding a bike to work and all that stuff. None of that stuff really made us unhappy. So it was kind of automatic to stick to that. And once we saw that money could have another purpose other than just buying additional stuff, that is investing and buying freedom, we were like, yeah, we should just put all our money toward that. It was like almost a no-brainer.
One of the things that we were doing too during this time period was every month we were tracking our net worth. And so that was really encouraging too. You know, we didn't have like a specific budget that we were trying to stick to, but instead we were trying to track how much do we get to save this month. And so being on the same page about and kind of rallying around this notion of like, let's see this number increase. Did we save more this month than last month? And then overall charting that progress along the way really encouraged us and kept us on the same team and kept us kind of striving for like, yeah, we're really busy, but like, could we book another wedding this weekend and try to make a little bit more money and see that number tick up again?
Yeah, I love that. The team aspect of it. That's how I've found my relationship with my wife, Laura, has really strengthened by following this path to FI, because we do think of ourselves as a team. And I'm curious, just going back to that inception point, Stephen, were there conversations? Was there an epiphany? Was there a book you read or articles that you came across? Or was it just something you guys happened upon when reflecting on what we want our lives to look like?
Pretty early on, we, like Lauren said, started tracking our net worth. And I started getting really into the idea of investing, like, oh, we're starting to see that we have a little bit of extra money laying around. What do we do with that? You're supposed to invest. I know that word, but I don't really know what that means. So we started to get into the idea of investing and toyed around with the idea that, hey, you know, investments is basically where your money pays you. And so if you were to have invested, you wouldn't really have to have a job anymore. So we were like kind of self-discovering this idea of financial independence. And then one day Lauren was at work and she actually emailed me this news article about this guy, Mr. Money Mustache. And she was like, this looks pretty cool. And it's like similar to what we've been talking about. And then I pretty much binged the entire blog and the rest is history.
I have so many follow-up questions, but before we tackle that, we'll be right back. So you're able to save $100,000 in 2 years. And this is one of my biggest problems that I feel like people don't recognize this, even as they're saying it out loud. We'll identify maybe some aspect of our life, our current income, our current expenses, and we'll treat it like that is static. And that is going to be the case for the rest of time, not realizing that there's variables and that we can have some control. You know, we can influence these different variables and change the equation. So for you guys, you're living on $22,000 a year. That's amazing. But it sounds like it's a continuation of a college lifestyle. And actually, I think there's something really there for college students coming out of college. If they can just maintain that college lifestyle just for an additional year or two, how far does that actually set you ahead in life? But beyond that, as you actually look to increasing your income, you two had a side hustle that you were doing, a photography business. You were doing weddings on the weekend. How else did you affect the income side of this equation over the coming years?
You know, one of the things that really impacted our ability to save was we kind of always had income coming in. As I kind of mentioned before, all through college, I was working. And anytime we moved, I always tried to get a job pretty quickly. I know that's not always possible, at least to get the job that you want. I didn't get my salaried position immediately. I was working, again, I was doing waitressing kind of in between because it's pretty good rate of pay and you can kind of step into that role pretty quickly wherever you are. So kind of always having income coming in regardless of, you know, what else is going on and what you're trying to accomplish. I think that was really impactful for us as well.
Another thing we did was we took advantage of some really good credit card sign-up bonuses and cash back and stuff along the way. So that added in a couple $1,000s a year because we were signing up for several different credit cards. And so that added a little boost to our income as well.
Let's just kind of place ourselves here. So this is 2 years on. So you're probably somewhere around 24, 25 if you graduated college at 22. I think you said you're living outside of Orlando, which is a pretty low cost of living area in general, and you have 100K in the bank. What do the conversations start looking like then? Is it, okay, let's stay here and do this for another 7 years and we hit FI? Is it, you know, I know, Lauren, you just said anytime we moved, you kind of snuck that in there. Obviously, travel has factored in significantly here, but anytime we moved certainly piqued my interest. So talk me through, like, where are you guys once you hit this 100K?
So I think for both of us, maybe this will sound a little bit complainy or something, but when you first graduate from college and you take a full-time job, it's a lot. It feels like a lot. And we had been at it really hard with side hustles and with minimal spending for 2 full years. So even though it was only 2 years, which sounds kind of funny in retrospect, we were burned out. And so we had just recently gotten married towards sort of the end of that 2 year period in 2014. And so we were talking about, well, what should we do for a honeymoon? You know, you're supposed to go on a honeymoon after you get married. Okay, well, that sounds like fun. But for us, for people who are spending $20,000, $22,000 a year to live combined, looking at honeymoon options, it was like, okay, spend $5,000 to go for 1 week to some place. And it was like, that doesn't really mix with our outlook on life or our normal lifestyle. It doesn't really make sense. We work really hard to save $5,000 or however much it may be. So we did want to do it, though. We wanted to do a honeymoon, and we wanted a break, too, because we were burned out. So we started having these discussions about, well, what if we kind of delay that a little bit? And what if we do something a lot bigger than that? And so I don't really know which one of us came up with this idea or how it even came about. But neither of us had ever been to Hawaii before, and it seemed like a really cool place. So we both said, well, why don't we do our honeymoon in Hawaii? But instead of spending thousands of dollars for plane tickets to get to Hawaii and back, and spending thousands of dollars on hotels while we're there, and rental cars, and all these super expensive things that make each day that you're there cost $500 or $1,000 practically per day, what if we spread out that honeymoon over a longer period of time and reduce the cost per unit time of that honeymoon down to a minimal level, like maybe even similar to the amount that we're spending right now in Florida. So our idea was, let's just ship off to Hawaii and say we live here now and stay for 6 months. And our goal will be to recharge ourselves, work a lot less, but work just enough to pay the bills. So, you know, the prior 2 years, we'd been saving like crazy, you know, higher than 50% savings rate. Let's bring that savings rate down to zero. Let's not touch our nest egg and let's recharge for 6 months. And so that's exactly what we did.
This is awesome. I love that you were talking about. Did you write down per unit?
Yes. Reduce the unit cost. I mean, that's so great. What an interesting line of thinking. As an accountant, I think of amortize the cost over a larger period, right? So if you're going to spend 10 days in Hawaii and it's $2,000 for the two of you to fly there.
Every hour is costing me.
Yeah. No, but seriously, right? It's $200 a day for the flight, right? But if you do 180 days, it's like $11 a day.
That is exactly the way we thought about it. And my background's in physics. So, of course, I'm thinking in terms of like rates and stuff like that. So, yeah, that's exactly what we're thinking.
Okay. So I've done something similar with cost of consumption and groceries. Like we did this grocery challenge and I had this one crazy month where we spent less than $200. But then I had another month where it was like $600 or more. And, you know, Brad said the problem here is that what you buy isn't really reflecting what you eat, which is what you're actually trying to measure the cost of your. And so really that moved me towards a cost of consumption model, which is very similar to what you're describing for this, you know, time unit that you're describing. Now, the reason I say all that is to say that as I took Brad up on this challenge, and I'll talk about it on a later show, on measuring cost of consumption, I came up with some very interesting data and it made me make some behavioral changes and, you know, dramatically changed, you know, what types of food I was buying. And actually sometimes it gave me more room in places that I wasn't expecting. Now for you guys, and when we're talking about measuring time units and rate of spend when you're on this trip, what was the most surprising thing that you found out you could spend, you know, time or money on without blowing up your whole model?
I think the biggest surprise to both of us is that we were able to find an apartment. It actually happened to be two bedrooms. We did not want a two bedroom, but we wanted a one bedroom. But we found a two bedroom apartment that was literally across the street from the ocean. We could hear waves crashing from our front door. And the rent was, I think, $965 a month in Hawaii. That was a huge surprise to both of us.
And it wasn't that much different than our rent in Orlando, to be honest, wow, for that one bedroom.
Yeah. Lauren, how is that possible? So as someone who's taken the expensive trip to Hawaii, how did you guys find that place? Is there any actionable tip there for the audience?
We scoured all of the Craigslist listings. We called property managers. I think we kind of got lucky in the sense that a unit became available there. And, you know, we wanted to be closer to the beach rather than up the mountain more. As you get further from the beach, things do get cheaper. But I would say that, you know, finding that opportunity was kind of lucky. Another thing that was surprising to me, we also found our car the same way. We bought a used Mazda Miata. I don't remember the year. Was it a 2001?
2000.
2000. And I think we bought it for $4,500.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the 6 months, we sold it for $5,600. And that's like the only increase in our net worth was that like $1,000. But I was surprised. I wasn't expecting that, one, we could sell it for more, and two, that, like, you know, every time you buy a used car, you know, there is somewhat of a gamble, but it was like a perfect island cruising vehicle. So it was, that one was another really surprising aspect to that trip.
And I'll throw something in for the actionable tips regarding like finding a place. So that apartment we found, obviously it was a steal and it was a great deal. And there was actually quite a bit of competition to try to get that apartment. And so, you know, people touring it at the same time as we were touring it, and we could tell like people were definitely applying for this place. So we had zero income at this point. We had no jobs or anything other than like contract income. Like I was tutoring some students via Skype and stuff like that, but no like W-2, like, let me show you my income. So when we filled out the application, this is another place where like having money in the bank really adds value that you don't realize to your life, right? So I told the apartment manager guy, I was like, listen, we don't have any income or anything. We have great credit scores. You'll run our credit. Everything will come back clean. But I just wanted to let you know, if you want me to pay the 6 months of rent today, I'll write you a check for the entire 6 months. And so I honestly think that got us the apartment.
Did he actually ask you to pay it all at once?
He did not. So I think me just offering that instilled in him the confidence that like, okay, these people are definitely going to pay their rent on time. And he was like, you don't have to do that. Don't worry about it. And then the next day we were approved for the
That's huge.
And I think that like also got him just like, I don't know, interested in us as people. He was like, oh, that's like cool. How do you just have, you know, this rent money available. And because he actually lived in that complex as well. And he was like, you're the kind of people that I want living as my neighbors. And I was like, that's funny. We don't even know you, but okay.
This is amazing. Okay. I actually wanted to talk about cash flowing Hawaii for $0. So to set the context for the audience, you described a situation where you stay there for 6 months for effectively $0. And what I think is intended when that statement is that you didn't have to draw down on your net worth in order to make this trip happen. But you said you guys didn't have any incomes. You'd left your job. Like, how does one cash flow, you know, the expenses that are associated with Hawaii? One, I guess, get a cheap car and get a steal on a mortgage. But there's still some costs associated with this. How'd you go about doing it?
One of the big things that worked for us this time around, before leaving, I gave my boss like tons of notice. I let him know probably months in advance that we were planning to take this trip. And I said, you know, I'm giving you this notice because I'm the only person who does my job. And, you know, I'm happy to train someone else, but I can also keep doing my job. There's a lot of what I do that can be done remotely. And if there's any parts of what I do that you would like done remotely while I'm in Hawaii, I will make that work. It's a 5-hour time difference, but I will wake up at 3 a.m. so that I can be available at 8 a.m. for you. I will do that. I'll commit to that if you would like to keep me on. And so that is something that they agreed to. I switched from being a full-time salaried employee to going to Hawaii as a part-time contractor and working maybe 10 hours a week. And that was a big boon to our finances during that time to kind of go into Hawaii knowing that we had that income. Whereas with Stephen being a public school teacher, that wasn't really an option. There's no like negotiating, hey, I'll teach a classroom full of students remotely. Like that's not really a thing. So
they wouldn't put me on the TV screen and just let me teach.
No projector of Stephen.
You're ahead of your time.
Yeah. So for him, it was a little bit different. He had to up and quit when we left. But as Stephen mentioned, he did pick up some tutoring opportunities both in person in Hawaii and also via Skype to some students that he had connections to. And then additionally, we sought out photography opportunities. And these were cold opportunities that we just kind of knocked on people's doors. And we were like, hey, you're a boutique with a website. Do you need photos of your products? Or hey, you're a dance studio. Do you need photos of your recitals? And kind of just cold approaches. But it did land some opportunities to make money on our passion of photography while we were in Hawaii.
And in total, we both worked about 10 hours a week on average. And what I would say is like, you might be looking at that and thinking, how did you afford your entire lifestyle on 10 hours a week? Well, of course, our expenses were pretty low. So that's part of it. But the other part is that on average, you can actually get paid more when you work fewer hours, especially if you're doing contract work like tutoring or something like that, because you can only take on the clients that actually are able to pay that higher rate. So you can charge a little more, reduce your hours, and actually make more, again, per unit time.
Steven's a big per unit time
per
person.
Unit time.
We are getting that sense. I love it. Hey, Lauren, I wanted to go back to that conversation you had with your boss about going to be a contractor. So you mentioned kind of in passing there the 3 a.m. thing, like I'll get up at 3 a.m. to do this. Say, did they take you up on it, or was it similar to that, hey, we'll pay 6 months of rent? Like, it just proves that you were serious. Like, were you able to be flexible with those 10 hours per week, or did they require you to be in there at certain hours?
Did you ever wake up at 3 a.m. to this work?
So to be fair, it was usually staying up till 3 a.m. and waking up at 3 a.m., if I'm completely honest. But yeah, I did make some of those choices. And I mean, if you want to call them sacrifices, but it didn't feel that way. I was enjoying my time. We would go out, look at the stars, come back, and then I'd do some work before going to bed. So it wasn't really like difficult on my part. I was just thankful that they were willing to be flexible. There were a few things, a few parts of my job that were required. You know, we had like a monthly newsletter that I had to get out at a certain time, but most things could be scheduled or automated and they were open to it. I was a good employee and they wanted to keep me around, and it was a lot easier to keep me doing a lot of the tasks that kind of were recurring and needed to be done rather than having to train up someone new. Although I did offer that as well, but I actually continued doing that freelance work for them through Hawaii. And then even after we got back from Hawaii. So to me, one of the big takeaways is just having a really good relationship and leaving your job on really good terms. I think telling them in advance, so far in advance, was really courteous and they appreciated that. It was respectful. And so they kind of treated me in kind and were like, you know, we could fire you now, but like you're a good employee and we want to keep you around and we're going to do that for you. And, you know, it was a small company, so they had the ability to be that flexible with me as well.
Yeah, I love that. Relationships matter. I think that's the most succinct way of putting it. And talking about your relationship with each other and this honeymoon, right? So this is a 6-month honeymoon, but obviously you're living there, you're working a little bit. How did you guys conceptualize this trip? Was it a honeymoon? Was it a vacation? Was it 6 months of living in Hawaii? And how did that impact thoughts for future trips?
I think the most important thing about the trip for us both was to take a break and make sure we weren't getting burned out and that we could complete our journey to financial independence someday, you know, while enjoying it along the way. So actually enjoying our lives was part of the reason to go on this honeymoon. So what we didn't really care too much about was treating it like a traditional honeymoon, like, you know, having like a fancy hotels or accommodations
champagne
or
every night,
champagne or yeah, like we didn't really care about, neither one of us cares about stuff like that. But we did care about the freedom aspect and the idea of like kind of discovering what makes both of us tick. So we pretty much, with the exception of those 10 hours a week that we had to do some work, which were relatively flexible, we pretty much had no schedule. So we got to sort of discover what would we do if we had all the time in the world. It was almost like a dry run for early retirement. So that was part of it for us as well. And what we learned was it's really fun. Like we found something, we found something fun to do every single day. We actually kept like a refrigerator list of things that we heard about on the island. Like, oh, there's this really cool, you know,
tide pools
that you should go check out or whatever. We had this whole list on our fridge, just a handwritten list. And every day we would just wake up at whatever time we happened to wake up.
You didn't use an alarm clock?
No alarm clock.
Lauren's going to sleep at 4 a.m., so I assume this is fairly late.
Yeah, so we would just wake up whenever we woke up, consult the list and say, well, like, which thing do you want to try today?
I don't know which one has the best unit time measurement.
So yeah, that's kind of how we approached our days. And I think that we sort of learned during that period that like early retirement is something that we're interested in and financial independence is worth it. And so not only did it recharge us by, you know, making us not have to work as much for a certain period of time, but it actually motivated us to say like, yeah, the thing we're after is something we want.
You two make such a power couple when it comes to getting on the same page with your finances and achieving this together. We've asked this question a different way, but I want to come back to it because it is so remarkable. You're making this choice, your friends, your peers, your family. What are they thinking? Is this like a second generation type deal where this is a choice that your parents made in some similar capacity? Is this, you're totally in the vanguard here? Are your friends saying, how do you guys afford this? I mean, just give us a sense for, you know, life doesn't happen in a vacuum. What's going on behind the scenes?
So it wasn't really like a second generation thing. I mean, neither of our parents did anything similar to this, really. They're pretty much on like the traditional life path, you know, just like have a career and work until normal retirement age and all that stuff. So I think where we kind of drew inspiration from, we glossed over this a little, I guess, but when we first graduated college, the summer after that, we did take a 45-day road trip and we drove all the way to Alaska and back. So that was kind of just like a, we graduated college, let's celebrate and do this thing. We did it super cheap in like a little Honda Civic and it was nothing fancy. We even slept in the back of the Honda Civic a lot of the time. But just learning that we enjoyed travel, I think partially inspired this trip. And working toward financial independence and getting a little bit burned out along the way, I really think just was the genesis of like, we need a break. And it needs to be more than a 1 week break. It needs to be a real break. And we have the freedom to take a break of arbitrary length because we have cash in the bank and we know how to keep our expenses super low. So I guess we kind of just invented the idea. I don't know.
And I don't think that our family and friends really, it wasn't something that they thought about on a regular basis enough to be like, what are you even doing? A lot of people were confused when we quit our jobs. But for some reason, I feel like our move to Hawaii, they were like, well, that makes sense that you are doing whatever you want. I don't know. I don't remember any conversations necessarily with my family where they were asking like, what are you going to do with your lives? But my parents are both pretty like entrepreneurial. So I think them knowing that we had my freelance income and then doing photography, they're like, oh, you're making it work, whatever. They weren't thrilled with the idea that we were like in the middle of the Pacific. But, you know, I don't think that they were necessarily put off by our plans. You know, financial independence was still something that when we told them about it, I don't know that they were necessarily on board, but I think in each chapter of our lives, we're like proving it more and more to them.
Yeah. And I mean, sometimes I think back to like the people who we're not directly close with, like not our parents and stuff, when we took this 6 months in Hawaii and we're like posting on Facebook or whatever every day that we're just like chilling in Hawaii. Some people probably just thought we were wealthy from like family money or something like that. People probably just made assumptions. I really have no idea what people thought at this point.
Yeah, we didn't field a lot of questions, although we did, a friend of ours did come and stay with us in Hawaii for like a few days or something because she was like, oh, you're there? I want to go there. And we're like, we have an extra room. Come on. So we did try to invite a lot of people to Hawaii, but I think like only one or two people took us up on it.
So when you guys embarked on this trip to Hawaii, was there a finite time period? Like, was it 6 months to the day and we have flights back home already set? Or was it, hey, let's see what happens? I mean, how did you think about the trip in terms of time period?
It was very much, hey, let's see what happens. We were open to the idea of it being shorter or longer. We had no definite plan about that because neither of us had a full-time job to come back to. But it turned out to be 6 months, and we had the idea that 6 months was like kind of like a rough target because when we got there, we found out that leases in Hawaii generally come in 6 month or 12 month terms. And we were like, okay, well, let's get a 6 month lease. And then when the lease was up, it was kind of like, all right, do we really want to sign an entire another 6 month lease? Probably not. Let's head on home and let's get back to the savings grind and all the stuff we're supposed to be doing.
So I think catching up to what you guys are working on now is really where I want to go with this. You know, we've been talking about this trip to Hawaii, this incredible trip where you're able to slow down. And this, I believe, was around 2015, 2016. But you guys have just this past year, 2019, pulled off an incredibly radical and ambitious trip around the United States, visiting every national park. And I think this is currently what makes Brad the most jealous of your situation, as I think he's planning something a little bit less ambitious. He's going to go a couple hours to a national park here.
Hey, we're going to Shenandoah tomorrow.
You got to start somewhere. It's first
That's
of
awesome.
All. Yeah. So anyways, I want to talk about, I think so many people are saying, how are you doing all this? This is my bucket list. I've set this aside and I've given myself permission to think about it in my 40s, 50s, and 60s. You're just doing it now. And it can't work out for you. That's not fair. All right. So help us out here. Like, what's the vision? How did you guys pull this off? How much did it cost every national park in the United States? I mean, there's the time cost, there's the opportunity cost, there's coming away from your jobs. We've heard about some of your strategies. What was your vision for this and how did it affect your path to financial independence?
So I'll preface by saying that after that Hawaii honeymoon, we did come back fully re-energized to save more. And we were able to upgrade our income significantly and actually decrease our expenses by buying a condo for cash. So we spent the next almost 3 years after that Hawaii honeymoon saving hardcore style before we got to that national park trip. But after doing that, having an even bigger cash cushion, we took this trip. And our plan for that, expenses-wise, was, again, keep it as cheap as possible.
Can I actually pause you before we do the trip? So you have a net worth of around $100,000 and you cash flow the Hawaii trip. You come back and you pay for a condo in cash. Like, this is such a compressed timeline. How did you pay for a condo cash?
So we did have a little more than $100,000. So we had saved $100,000 during that 2 years and we had a little bit left over from stuff we had saved during college and stuff like that. But the condo that we bought in Gainesville, which is a pretty low cost of living area, was only $71,000. So we're actually sitting in it right now. That's where we're broadcasting from. But
broadcasting live from a $71,000 condo in Gainesville, Florida.
Yeah. So now I think it's worth over $100,000. So we've done pretty well on this place too. But yeah, that's how we bought it for cash. It was well within that $100,000 price range.
So again, this is, you have a lifestyle that costs around $22,000. You upgrade your incomes. Your net worth of $100,000 is growing a little bit more. I would have imagined that some of that would have been inside of a 401k or some sort of tax advantage vehicle. How did you get enough to, you know, pay $71,000 for a house? Like, just help our audience with that. How did that math work out?
Yeah, so we had only been able to max out Roth IRAs for 2 years because we had only really had significant income for 2 years. So there was not very much in tax advantage vehicles. And we did not max out 401ks or anything like that. We just contributed just enough to get the match.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. I was like, don't leave that part out.
So we didn't have that much money in tax advantage space, which maybe was a mistake, maybe not. if we did need to tap those Roth IRAs, we started with Roths in part because I think mathematically it made sense, but also in part as a young person, I think it's a great idea to start out with Roth IRAs, not traditional, because you can withdraw your contributions without paying any taxes or penalties on that because you've already paid the income tax. We didn't end up having to do that, but that was also on our mind as well, is that like the money in those Roth IRAs is accessible. So that made us feel a little more comfortable with spending so much on a house up front in cash, which did drain a significant portion of our net worth. Well, not really our net worth, but
that's completely fair. And that was just kind of what I was getting to. As you were saving, there was less of a focus on your 401k for those early years, getting the match. You were making sure you took advantage of the Roth IRA because you were in a relatively low tax bracket. And the rest of it was going in some sort of taxable savings account or taxable investment.
Correct. So yeah, our largest account at this time was definitely a taxable brokerage account. And to this day, our largest account is a taxable brokerage account.
Cool. So after you bought this condo, your yearly expenses went from roughly 22K down to what? Do you have a sense of that?
I think our lowest expenses for a year, and we don't really track them that diligently. We mostly track our change in net worth month to month, but our lowest expenses for a year probably was our first year after getting that condo or this condo. And I think we had our expenses down to probably $18,000 or $19,000 a year total between the two of us.
All right. So $18,000, $19,000 a year in expenses. And Brad, is there anything you want to hop in there? I want to find out about this national park strip.
No, I do too.
I just couldn't let it slide. I mean, you paid for a condo. What?
Oh, by the way.
Just drop that one in there, comma.
But I think there is a kind of a transition here, right? So you guys are back working full time. You're making more income. I assume you still have the photography side hustle, tutoring, et cetera. So you get to a point where, okay, is it wanderlust? Was it, okay, we want another one of these recharge periods? Like, talk us through that thought process of, hey, we're going to take 7 months and drive around the U.S. and associated areas.
Yeah, so for us, you know, we kind of saved really hard before Hawaii, got kind of burnt out. And then in Hawaii, we felt really renewed and we're like, let's get back to the grind. Let's do this. So we decided to move back to Gainesville, where our college is, our alma mater, and we started the job search. So Stephen kind of continued doing tutoring for a little while on his own. And I was able to find a job kind of in my field doing marketing. But at this point, it was way higher pay than I had achieved previously. And so it was with a small startup, and I was able to, over, you know, the 2 to 3 years I was working there, significantly increase my rate of pay as well with bonuses and salary bumps. And I kind of always pushed for those things at my reviews. And so on my side of things, I was, you know, working really hard to increase my rate of pay. And that was a lot of effort, you know, working for a small business, working in a salaried position. You don't always get to really recognize how hard you're working. You don't get paid necessarily for the time that you're at home checking emails just to stay on top of things. And so it kind of led to that burnout again. Stephen, pretty early on, he was doing tutoring individually as a small business himself, but then he was taken on by a company here in town to do tutoring for them. And so, you know, he was also able, it was a smaller company, kind of same deal in this startup environment. A lot of those companies, if they're successful, can grow pretty quickly. And that leads to higher rate of pay for employees as well, more so than, you know, maybe a more established company where you get a 1% or 2% raise annually to keep up with inflation, basically.
So I can also throw in a little like actionable tip as far as when we came back from that Hawaii honeymoon and tried to increase our incomes. You know, Lauren found this good job pretty early on, and I was not finding anything that I was super interested in or whatever in terms of like traditional jobs. So I was being pretty successful, like I said before, and increasing my hourly rate with tutoring when we were in Hawaii. And so I was like, why don't I just continue this private tutoring thing? It actually pays pretty well. So when we got back from Hawaii, you know, we moved back to Gainesville, which is near the University of Florida, big school. So what I did was I actually just made some business cards. Went on Vistaprint or whatever and made like 1,000 business cards. And I would just go hang out outside the lecture halls on exam days as students would come out, because every single student would file out at the same time. And I would just hit every single one of them with a business card. And I was able to fill up over 40 hours a week of private tutoring, like wow, almost instantaneously with that method.
So there's some services out there that offer, you know, they kind of handle the back end for you and match you up with the clients. I think VIP Kids is probably one of the more prominent ones that I've heard about. And I believe an hourly rate that maybe ranges somewhere in between $15 to $25 an hour. That may or may not be accurate. But I'm just curious, you, again, looking at this time unit measurement and optimizing and cold calling, there, I would expect, you know, that if you are getting rid of the middleman and finding the clients yourself, you're going to be able to make more. You're just paying less overhead. So what did you find as an average hourly rate that you were able to obtain when you were doing this?
So I'll preface this by saying that I was tutoring college level physics, which is notoriously a difficult class to get a tutor for. So I think I was able to command a little bit higher rate because of that. But I started out at $35 an hour. And once my schedule kind of filled up instantaneously, like 40 plus hours a week, I was like, well, I guess I need to increase my prices because I have more students than I can handle. So I increased them $5 an hour at a time. And by the time I got hired by that company, who I actually still do contract work for today, I was up to $60 an hour consistently charging for private tutoring for physics.
So Stephen, the increase in price. So I think this is going to be interesting for a lot of people, even outside of tutoring, right? You have clients, you've realized, okay, maybe I'm undercharging, right? Since I filled up instantly and okay, I've got to raise my prices. Now, did you grandfather anybody into the lower price? Did you tell them, hey, I'm going to change this for existing clients in 2 weeks, a month or whatever, or just, hey, this is my new price? Like, talk people through how you communicated with your current clients about that.
So I would normally see students through to the end of a semester. So I would plan the price increases to be at a semester cutoff point. That way, no student, you know, felt like they were forced to pay the price in order to keep doing tutoring with me for their class that they were currently in. But yeah, I didn't grandfather people in permanently because that just didn't make sense for me when I had a schedule that was completely full and I was turning other students away. So I increased my prices basically at semester breaks, and I found that that worked pretty well.
So I apologize to our audience for our inability to follow a straight and narrow path here with regards to story arc, but I want to come back and talk about national parks. And I think as our audience has kind of followed you on this journey that you've kind of laid out for us, we can see how you crushed your expenses and how both of you were able to double and triple your salaries over time, you know, at a very, shall I say, back of the envelope level, dare I?
My pet phrase.
using some simple calculations, you'd say you guys are probably starting to feel like you're getting close to financial independence. When you made the choice to pursue this national parks adventure, did you feel like you were financially independent?
I think we felt that we were at an absolute bare bones level of financial independence. Like if I was forced to stop working and never make another penny at a job for the rest of my life, you know, could we be okay from that point forward? I think the answer was maybe yes, if we wanted to stay at an absolute bare bones expenses forever until the day we die.
Same condo, et cetera.
So I would say yes and no, but we definitely had the plan to come back from the national park trip renewed again and go back to work full time and save even more and just give ourselves a little bit more of a buffer. Because here we are, like we're enjoying ourselves along the way. It's not painful to work toward financial independence because we're taking these breaks and it's fun, right? So we expected to come back the same way that we came back from Hawaii, like ready to like put our nose to the pavement and just like save really hard, harder than ever before. And in fact, we're back now. And it turned out that that wasn't really the case. We were sort of ready to embrace financial independence to some extent. So we actually ended up kind of backtracking on that a little. And we both work part-time and do contract work. And we're still saving, in fact, still higher than 50% savings rate. But we're not working anywhere near full-time anymore.
That's very cool. Okay, well, let's talk about the actual national park. So you guys are kind of operating from a place, a strategic place of strength, where you know you can go back into the workforce if you need to. You're making a choice to stay out, limiting the amount of hours you work, cash flow your life, which doesn't cost as much, and somehow still obtaining a 50% plus savings rate with all of that. But you guys are going to go, in 2019, you took 6 months plus to go around the country, go to all the national parks. Mechanically, what did that look like? Were you doing this in the back of a Honda Civic?
No.
Not this time. This time we were a little bit smarter about it. So in thinking about this trip, you know, we kind of had that same kind of entering into burnout mode after working at our full-time jobs for a few years again and saving harder. So we were like, what can we do this time around? You know, we had been to some national parks in the past just casually in our travels. And we were like, they're all pretty cool. How many are there? About 60. Okay, if we, you know, kind of mapped it out roughly, could we do that in like a sabbatical something, 6-ish months like Hawaii? And looks like probably 8 months if we did, if we took from January to the fall semester, because that's what's busiest for Stephen, you know, and we kind of took the same approach we did with Hawaii. We were like, let's talk to our bosses, let's see what they're willing to do. And to keep expenses low, instead of a Honda Civic, what if we got a van? And then that kind of led us down a rabbit hole of research to figure out, you know, did we want an RV? Did we want these like Sprinter van life vans? Do we want a converted van? You know, what all did we actually need? And knowing us and our kind of extreme frugality and Stephen's obsession with rates, we were like, what's the best gas mileage vehicle? Definitely not an RV.
Well, part of that too, just to be clear, is we wanted something that was really good gas mileage because we were going to buy it ahead of time. We actually bought it nearly a year in advance, I think.
Like 6 months.
And we always only own one vehicle at a time. We've always shared one vehicle and I ride my bike to work. So we wanted something that Lauren could drive to work and we could drive wherever necessary in between and keep as our main vehicle. So it needed to get really good gas mileage for that reason. And also the fact that our trip would be almost 40,000 miles of driving. So gas mileage was like one of our top concerns for getting a vehicle for this trip.
So the options kind of quickly narrowed themselves down to what we decided on was a Nissan NV200. We went to a local dealership to just test drive it, see if it was something we would enjoy driving because I'm not used to driving a large vehicle. You know, our history is like little sedans like a Honda Civic. And so we test drove it. Stephen laid down in the back of one. I'm sure that the car salesman was like, what has this guy been doing?
Breaking Bad.
But yes, but it was like just big enough in the back for Stephen to fully extend his body. And we were like, okay, let's take some measurements. And it turned out that a full size bed could fit in the back of the van. And so we're like,
just barely.
It just fit. And so that was like our perfect solution. We're like, great, we'll build a little platform for storage underneath this mattress. We'll sleep on the mattress, put all our stuff underneath it. And that'll be home for however long it takes to go to all the national parks. So that was kind of what we did. We started looking for used options because we weren't going to buy one new. And
at this point, like the most expensive vehicle we had ever purchased in our lives was $5,500. So looking at these vans was a little bit of a mind shift change for us. You know, at first we looked at RVs and they're looking at like even used, you can buy one for like $50,000 and $100,000, crazy amounts of money that we would never spend on a depreciating asset like that. But when we started to look at these Nissan NV200 vans, we were able to find one used for $12,300. And that was way more than we had ever spent on a vehicle before. But it felt like it was worth it to get one that only had like 50 something thousand miles on it because we really needed it to be as reliable as possible, given that we were going to be driving in really remote places where we wouldn't have cell service or anything. So we wanted something very new and very reliable. So we bought something that was twice the price of anything we've ever bought before. So that felt like a huge splurge for us. But at the same time, sleeping in the back of the van probably saved us around $15,000 over the course of the trip in terms of just hotel costs.
So we're talking about a $12,000 vehicle here that you guys drive over the following 8 months or so. I'm actually curious if you have any real big highlights. You went to 60 parks. Which ones right now, as soon as I said that, did you think of? Like, oh, we got to go back there. And then two, do you guys still have the van?
We do still have the van. It's our only vehicle. We thought we were going to sell it immediately after the trip and just go back to something like a Honda Civic or whatever. But we found that since it's decent on gas mileage and it's also winter right now in Florida, the weather is perfect for sleeping in the back of the van. So we're planning on taking some shorter trips just around Florida because it's really nice to sleep in the van when it's like 40 to 50 degrees outside at night. And that's right around where it is now in most parts of Florida. So we are keeping the van for now, at least through the winter. We'll see about after that. And we actually kept a ranked list of every national park while we were on the trip. And each one we visited, we would insert into that list so that we'd have like a complete set in order at the end, just like, you know, to tell people about or put on our blog or whatever. And we still haven't posted that blog post yet at the time of recording this, but our top seven, we decided, are kind of tied for first place. So I'll just like run them off to you really quick. In no particular order: Death Valley, Yosemite, Yellowstone, Hawaii Volcanoes, American Samoa, Carlsbad Caverns, and Canyonlands. Those are our top seven that we consider to be tied for first place in terms of national parks. Wow. There's so many good ones out there. They're almost all of them are just absolutely amazing.
And lots of really awesome like states that you could just spend a lot of time in. Like there are 8 national parks in Alaska. There are 5 in Utah. There's, I think, are there 9 in California? But yeah, like there's just places to go that are just worth embedding into that state for a little while. And hopefully with keeping the van, we're going to be able to do that shortly.
Nice. So I want to talk about the logistics. So my family, we actually have a map of the national parks up in our living room with like little stickers of where we've been. And it's actually really interesting when you look at it. There's only about a dozen east of like Texas, let's say, right? Yeah. And there's about a dozen outside of the 48 states. Right. Mm-hmm. So like you said, there's one in American Samoa. I think there's a couple in Hawaii, 7 or
Virgin
so.
Virgin Islands.
There's 7 or so in Alaska, some of which are not accessible by car. Talk
most
us through like,
yeah,
how did you plan this trip? Like what does this look like?
So most of the trip we couldn't actually plan. I had the first maybe 10 or so parks planned for when we took off in January of last year. However, at that time, the government was shut down, and so we weren't really sure what to expect. The national parks themselves were open, the land, but not visitor centers. And so if anything, if any park was something that you had to enter through like a closed gate, you weren't going to be able to. And anything like Carlsbad Caverns, where you'd have to go through the visitor center to get to, no go. So those first 10 parks stayed roughly the same, with the exception of Carlsbad Caverns. We headed west first, and then when we started trying to venture our way north, this was still like January, February, it was winter, and I'm from Florida, so I wasn't really anticipating what that meant, and that, you know, sometimes the van doors would be frozen shut. Like that wasn't a possibility in my mind when we started. And so after those first 10, we kind of only planned a couple in advance, with the exception of those remote parks where, you know, there was some planning to be done in terms of flights and hotels. And so for those things, we were maybe a couple weeks out. With Alaska, I think we were about a month or so out, or 2 months out of planning it. But most of everything else was kind of on the fly, and we just kind of drove where we needed to drive based on the weather and kind of where we were geographically. I think we ended up going through Utah like 3 times because of weather inconveniences, and it was the fastest route to get to the next park. So we mostly kind of did it in little loops out west as the weather got better.
So Stephen, per unit basis, right? American Samoa. Yeah. Did you contemplate not going, or was the overriding concern to check off all 61?
Okay, so yeah, not going to any of the parks was not an option. And actually, that's part of what made the trip, I think, so fun for us, is that some of them are a huge challenge to get to. Actually, American Samoa is a cakewalk compared to some of the ones in Alaska. But yeah, not going to one was not an option. We had a goal, absolutely, we had to go to every single national park. And that was just like a personal pride type of thing that we wanted to do that. And that, I think, is part of what like brought us closer together as a team on the trip, was we have a goal above all else. Like we got to get to the next park. We got to make sure we get them all. We got to make sure we plan this and that ahead of time and make sure that everything comes together. And it put us like on a project together that at the end was a huge project that we could say we did it and like high five each other. And so I think that was like a really good like unintended benefit of having that goal and actually sticking to it. So I had to let go of that whole like how much does this park cost per unit time thing, especially in Alaska. So getting to like Gates of the Arctic National Park and Kobuk Valley National Park, which are on the north slope of Alaska, you have to charter a plane from a haul road that is like a gravel road that like regular vehicles aren't even supposed to go on. It's really for like ice road truckers delivering oil and stuff. You have to go on that, then charter a plane just by yourself, pay for the whole plane and pilot and everything, to take you to a tiny town that's off the road system, to then charter a plane to take you into the national parks by yourself. And so
it was literally the three of us and the pilot. Wow. And that's the size of the plane too. Like I could touch him, the pilot, and like see my stuff behind us. It was like flying in a smaller than a Honda Civic.
Yeah. So just going to those two parks by itself cost us thousands of dollars. And so per unit time definitely was a questionable decision. But we got to say that we've been somewhere that almost no one has been. I'm not sure we've even met anyone who's ever been to either of those places. And we got to say that we completed our goal. And so to us, that was worth it.
And one of our goals kind of baked into that like completest goal was coming away with a really strong image from each park as well. Being photographers, we challenged ourselves to, you know, take on like, we're not leaving until we get something we're proud of. And so like that kind of impacted how long we stayed at each park, as well as, you know, keeping us on the same page and kind of working together to like create the best image.
Yeah, honestly, neither one of us, we can't stress that enough, is that like having goals together, or just having goals in general in your life that you're working toward on a daily basis, improves your happiness immensely. And so, yeah, having that goal of like, okay, we're going to grow as photographers and come away from each park with a really great image, it made even the parks, like there were a couple parks that honestly were like, all right, this isn't our favorite place in the entire world or whatever. But it made going to those places totally worth it still, because we had a specific goal when we got there. And so we had to work toward that goal and say like, all right, how do we take this place that doesn't really strike our fancy as much as the others? How do we make it look amazing in a really great photograph? And so it also challenged us to stay longer in certain places that we were like otherwise ready to leave, to say, how can we get a really amazing photo here? And so just setting goals in general, it doesn't have to be photography, it doesn't have to be anything, it can be financial or educational or whatever, but setting goals and achieving them just immensely improves your happiness and makes you have something worth working toward.
If we weren't being completists about the parks and going to all of them, even the really remote ones that you mentioned, it definitely would have brought costs down to have just stayed in the lower 48 states that you can access by our van, as opposed to taking these flights. I think it decreased the cost by...
Yeah, removing the 12 most expensive parks to access reduces the cost of the trip by 41%, actually.
Wow. Andrew, who's editing this video, this is like his life goal right now. So I guarantee you he's taking notes. But I also suspect there's a lot of people that have similar goals. Maybe not completionism, but they do want to tackle some of these national parks. People are excited by your story. They want to find out more. What is the best way for someone to connect with you?
So our blog is tripofalifestyle.com. And we love hearing from people. We'll answer your emails if you email us. And Facebook is a really good platform too to start discussions on. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram, Trip of a Lifestyle, and Twitter. Our username is annoyingly cut off by the character limit. It's TOA Lifestyle, so you can tweet at us as well.
Tell us a little bit more about how you picked that name out for your website, Trip of a Lifestyle. What does that mean to you?
I think that was Lauren's idea.
Yeah, so we actually started our blog while we were on the trip. Another fun us goal that we could work on together, being like these business owners slash bloggers. But for us, we were on the trip and we were like, you know, part of what makes these trips doable for us, these like crazy long-term travel months at a time, is approaching it as a lifestyle change rather than a vacation. We kind of alluded to this with our talk about Hawaii, but approaching it as a lifestyle means we bought used bicycles and sold them back in Hawaii. Instead of renting snorkel gear or a GoPro or something, we had those things with us, and then kind of reselling anything you don't use. That's what happened for us in Hawaii. But approaching it as a lifestyle, things that, you know, I wouldn't normally spend kind of an excursion cost of renting bicycles in a park or doing things that are extracurricular in a sense. We paid for a park pass. I think it was like $80 to go to all the national parks. It covers all the entrance fees.
And you got your money's worth.
Yes. And that alone was our entertainment costs kind of in total, right? Because we, every day got to go somewhere completely different, completely interesting, worthy of our time. And the only time that we actually did something extra was like, oh, maybe this park has some really good bike trails, so we'll rent bikes because we weren't able to bring ours with us. But we didn't do that every time. Whereas on a vacation, a lot of times the mindset is like, I'm only going to do this once. You know, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity, so I got to do it all. Whereas if it's your lifestyle and you have the idea that like, oh, I can come back to this, or it's not just, I got to do it all, I can just enjoy my time, take it slow. That was kind of the idea that I had, is it, that it's more of a lifestyle, and our lifestyle being frugal translated to these trips.
Well, I think on most shows, that would be the end of the episode. But on this show, we would love to give you the chance to tackle the hot seat. Are you ready for this?
Let's do it.
In a world drowning in debt and rampant consumption, trapped by the chains of lifestyle inflation, these questions highlight the secrets of those who have broken free. Welcome to the Choose FI Hot Seat.
All right. Question number one. What is your favorite blog, podcast, or book of all time?
So I know this is probably the boring answer, but it's got to be Mr. Money Mustache for us, since that's kind of what kicked this whole thing off for us and gave us like the idea to be working toward it.
All right. Question number two, an inflection point in your life that was especially memorable or meaningful.
So I think our biggest inflection point is definitely that 6 months in Hawaii. For us, it did a few things. Number one, it acted as a dry run for early retirement and showed us that, no, we would not be bored. We have plenty to do even without full-time jobs. And number two, it also demonstrated to us that the freedom that we had been gaining by saving money was real. It actually showed us that, yes, you can walk away from your job at any arbitrary point, have fun, and come back to it. And that's okay. And in fact, when we came back to it, we had a significant jump in income, you know, forcing us to job hop, made us learn that, like, wow, it's actually worth it to reevaluate your skill set and how much money you're worth after you've learned a bunch of stuff and become a better employee for the last 2 years. And sometimes the best way to do that is a job hop. So it just taught us so many different things about ourselves, and it improved our relationship and all kinds of stuff. So I would say that's definitely an inflection point for us.
All right, question number three, and I suspect you have a lot of options to choose from here. What is your favorite life hack?
Okay, so don't revoke my FI card, but it has to do with Starbucks. On our last trip, when we were on the road, we had to make time for our work. And so sometimes that would come in the form of needing to get like 8 hours worth of work done in a single day. And so we would go to Starbucks, get our $4 latte, as much as that pained us, we made it worth it by getting their free refills. So they have a rule that if you're in the store, you can get free refills. And so between the two of us, we could drink as much coffee as we want. And
that rule still exists?
It does. And so we not only got free coffee, but we free in the form of these refills, but we also got free workspace. So we would be able to sit, charge our phones, our computers, do our work for sometimes until closing. And, you know, it made it actually worth that $4 drink, like, right, above and beyond. So,
and the great thing is, because they're traveling all over the country, Brad, there's not one manager to get angry at them when it's like 3 weeks in they've been doing
that
this.
You know? That's true.
Awesome. There's some truth to that.
Yeah, that's a pretty good deal. $8 for an office for a day for two plus free coffee. Yeah, that'll.
Well, we would just buy one coffee and share it. So...
Even better deal. Even better value.
Oh my goodness!
Someone listen to this. Keep your judgment. Keep your judgment. Let's just enjoy this moment.
Oh, I was not expecting that. All right, guys. Question number four: your biggest financial mistake.
So our biggest financial mistake, ironically, was seeing a financial advisor. And specifically, we saw a commission-based financial advisor without even really realizing it, fresh out of college. So pretty soon, right after college, we had scrounged together $10,000 to invest. And so we really didn't know the first thing about investing. So we thought the natural thing is, you know, walk down to the bank and see a financial advisor and they'll tell you what to do. So this advisor actually sold us into this super high fee, actively managed bond fund for some reason for 22-year-olds.
I'm laughing, and, but it's out of pain. Like I'm
yeah, no, yeah. It's pretty terrible, and I'm embarrassed to even admit that we did it, but we did. We put our $10,000 in that. We paid a load fee of like several hundred dollars to put the money in. And then, of course, it underperformed the stock market, and the expense ratio was higher than index funds because it was actively managed. And pretty soon after, through Mr. Money Mustache, for the most part, we learned that that was probably a stupid call, and we sold the shares of that fund, not at too much of a loss or anything like that. But it's not that it affected us massively financially, but it just like felt bad. And so, you know, we try to give good investing advice to young people so that they don't make that same mistake up front and they can start off on the right foot with that.
Yeah, I was going to say, don't be embarrassed. I mean, not only did you recover so quickly that it's going to be barely a rounding error as you look back, but like there's hundreds of thousands of people that will be hearing your story and learning from it. So thanks for sharing. All right. Question number five, the advice you would give your younger self.
So definitely I would tell my younger self or any young person, especially like in college, don't get so caught up in that you have to be on one specific path. So don't shoehorn yourself into, I'm majoring in this, I'm going to go in grad school in this right after I graduate, then I'm going to become this right after grad school, and then I'm going to get promoted to this position. Life doesn't work like that. It's actually pretty unlikely to come out that way. And if you try to force yourself to make it come out that way, you'll probably get it done, but you might miss out on a lot of other opportunities along the way. And you might be doing something that's not in your best interest long term in terms of happiness. So our path has shifted a whole bunch of times. And what we keep finding is that if you're just like a relatively smart and capable person, opportunities will be knocking on your door all the time, all kinds of different opportunities. And you need to be open to those opportunities and open to changing throughout your life. So don't shoehorn yourself into one pathway.
Yeah, that is wonderful advice. And all right, guys, we got one last question. I'm going to throw you for a loop. Other than your Nissan van and the full-size bed that just fit, what was the purchase you've made over the last 12 months that has added the most value to your life?
So we actually just reenacted our Planet Fitness membership. That was a huge component to making our van life work. On the road, we actually mostly used it for showers. There are like 2,000 Planet Fitness gyms across the country. And so for about $20 a month, which is their highest level of membership, two people can go. And so we would roll up sometimes at 2 a.m, do a quick workout, shower, and roll back into bed.
Or not do a workout at all. Sometimes just
shower.
We called it
Planet Fitness is a very interesting idea of what exercise looks like to begin with sometimes. So, you know, whether it's enjoying a slice of pizza on your way out the door or the, and if you guys want to shower, I promise you that's more exercise than some people are getting inside of Planet Fitness.
So yeah, that was one of our biggest hacks, was using our Planet Fitness membership as a shower membership for nationwide 24/7 shower access while sleeping in the back of a van. So we just reinstated that because we're looking forward to more travels this year. And to do that, we need our shower.
I hear you. Why do you stay with Planet Fitness? Because I'm trying to get showers on the road. Can't close that down. They're conveniently on the way to every single national park in the country. Have you realized that?
It's true.
Planet Fitness, we're here when you are.
Yeah.
All right. Wow. Thank you so much, guys, for coming on the show today. On behalf of us and the audience, thank you. This has been an absolute blast.
Thanks for having us.
It was super fun.
All right, my friends, if you got value from today's episode, and if you've been getting value from the episodes up to this point, just take 1 second, like, comment, subscribe on your platform or player of choice, whether or not that be a podcast player or it be on YouTube, just go ahead and press that subscribe button. It just lets the providers know you're getting value from the show and you want to be here when we produce additional content. If you want to support us and what we're doing here at Choose FI, here are 3 easy ways. 1, if you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, just head to choosefi.com/travel, take our free class for travel rewards. When you're ready to get started, just head to choosefi.com/cards to get started on your travel rewards journey today. All right, 2, check out our book, Choosefi, Your Blueprint to Financial Independence, which can be found anywhere that books are found, or very easily, you can find it at choosefi.com/book. Add it to your bookshelves, get it for a friend, or request that your local library pick up a copy for your entire community. And 3, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members that might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 100. It's a fantastic starting place. And to get started on their own path to financial independence, you can have them go to choosefi.com/start. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth, one life hack at a time.